Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Right Club, a podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Steph and today I'm joined by Pat, Nicola, Linda and Teresa.
Hello.
Hiya. Hi.
This week on Write Club, we are going to hear Teresa read from her work in progress, A Village Called Far Away, and then we'll give her some feedback, just the way we do at our Write Club meetings. Pat's going to solve the mystery of the Oxford comma, and then we'll be talking about why we write and what drives us. But first, Linda is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Yay!
Mm-hmm. Okay, are you ready, everybody?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. I'm going to give you three clues, and you have to name the novel as quickly as you can. No shouting out the answer, but let me know when you think you've got it. Right?
Yep.
Here we go. This coming-of-age book, published in 1916, was the author's first novel and introduces a character who will feature prominently in his next larger masterpiece.
Ooh. 1916.
Yeah. Quote, it pained him that he did not know well what politics meant and that he did not know where the universe ended. He felt small and weak. Steph looks studious.
I'm just looking blank for the benefit of our listeners.
Okay. I'll give you an easy one. First line. Once upon a time, and a very good time it was, there was a moo cow coming down along the road.
Oh,
and this moo cow that was coming down along the road met a nicened little boy named Baby Taku.
Yes.
Nope. Still no.
Teresa, I think. What do you think, Teresa?
I think it's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce.
Oh,
yes.
God, very highbrow.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was the move. Very good. Oh, I wonder if anybody got it.
At home.
I don't know at home. I wonder if they did. If you did, please let us know.
Is that Dylan Thomas?
No, it's James Joyce.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I've got a whole suitcase, if not three suitcases, of books that I should read.
Yeah, that's the trouble. There's so many books and
so little time.
That was really good, Linda. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll have to add that to my bedside table, definitely. Right, okay, well, now we've got our brains in gear. We're going to listen to Teresa reading from her work in progress, which is A Village Called Far Away. It's a novel. Teresa, what inspired A Village Called Far Away?
Well, as you guys know, I spend quite a lot of time in Greece, and I suppose it comes from my love of Greece and affection for the Greek people and the kindness and generosity that I've experienced in Greece. That I had this idea. I was fascinated by seeing the village priest in the Cathenaeum playing chess on a computer, which seemed so incongruous in his kind of black dress and everything. But in my novel, I've stripped away computers and mobile phones. But other than that, I think it fairly reflects my experience of Greek village life in terms of the lifestyle. Obviously, the story's made up and the characters.
Yeah, lovely. Well,
let me ask for what's a Cathenaeum?
Oh, a coffee shop, village coffee shop.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Largely frequented by men, I've discovered.
Oh, really?
But not exclusively. But yeah, you can get coffee, you can get wine, ouzo there. But usually just snacks, not
They're normally quite smoky, aren't they?
They can.
It's part of European law.
Well, we're all sitting comfortably, so start whenever you're ready, please.
Chapter 1, Poison. Some bastard's poisoning my dog. The priest hesitated for a second, with the black bishop held delicately between his thumb and forefinger. He disliked having his chess game disturbed, and was annoyed with the large man who had crashed noisily into the cathedral, letting the door bang against the nearest table. He placed the bishop on the board, savouring the delicious moment before his opponent realised that he was caught in a double pincer movement. Are you all deaf in here? Some malacca poisoned my best hunting dog. What kind of a dirty trick is that? Would that be the dog that's been keeping the whole village awake every night for weeks? The priest asked calmly. Dogs bark, it's in their nature. That doesn't mean it's okay to kill them. Anyway, if you want to kill something, you should shoot it outright, not torture it with poison. Nikos, you should feed your dogs sometimes. Then maybe they wouldn't take poisoned meat from strangers. Whose side are you on? Is it Christian to poison God's creatures? Anyway, who says it was a stranger? When did you last see a stranger around here anyway? At this point, the priest's opponent, a watery-eyed old man, decided to join in the conversation. There were those gypsies that passed through about 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago? You think they gave my dog some kind of delayed action poison? No, but they were strangers, the old man reasoned mildly. The priest sighed. No, it's not a good thing to poison animals, and neither is it good to chain them up without exercise and to starve them. Now, I don't think you need a priest unless you want to pay for a funeral for the dog, so please shut up and let me continue beating Baba Christo at chess. Nikos picked up a chair, banged it down at a table, and threw himself into it as he shouted, I want a beer. Remembering the old woman who ran the cafe, he was immediately repentant and somewhat sheepishly addressed her. Please, Kyria Angeliki, a beer if it's no trouble. Angeliki pulled herself painfully from her chair, took hold of her stick, and made her way over to the fridge. She took a bottle of beer from it, then tottered over to the counter, where she picked up a less than sparkling glass and the bottle opener. Contriving to hold all three of these in the hand that was not needed for the stick, she hobbled over to Nikos, put the beer and the glass on the table, and opened the bottle. Resting a hand on his shoulder, she gently said, I'm sorry about your dog, my child. It was a wicked thing to do. Nikos grunted his thanks as he poured his beer. Having watched this scene in silence, the priest turned his attention back to the game in hand. Take your time, Baba Christo, take your time. But I think you'll have to admit that I've beaten you this time. Carefully, carefully, the old man replied. The game is not over yet. Silence once more descended on the cafeteria. Time passed. An old man came in and took his accustomed seat. Wordlessly, Angeliki got up and went to make his daily coffee. She knew how to make it to his exact taste. There was no hurry. No one was going anywhere. In fact, the longer it took to make the coffee, the better. The game dragged. The afternoon dragged. The clock ticked. The day passed much like any other, just the way the inhabitants of this forgotten village liked it. At 3:15, the 2:30 bus sounded its horn to warn of its arrival in the village, before turning in the square outside the Caponeo to commence its journey back over the mountains to the city. The chess game continued with only the occasional murmured remark. A little after 4, a small girl entered the coffee shop and approached the priest shyly. Can I help you, my child? Does someone want the priest? Yes, Papa, she almost whispered. My grandma says to please come. Kyria Paniotta is dying. Baba Christo and Kyria Angeliki crossed themselves reverently. The priest stroked the girl's hair, his hand massive against her small head, as he asked, Who is your grandmother, my child? The old woman Paniotta had been claiming to be dying for years, but for all her complaints, she had never been too ill to carry her own ladder to the olive grove, nor to climb the trees and pick the olives for 8 hours a day. She carried the full sacks to the roadside too, where a neighbour with a tractor picked them up for her. And she whitewashed her own house and the outside of the church before Easter every year. My yaya is Kyria Evangelia, the girl said, not without a certain amount of pride. Then we must not delay, said the priest, taking the little girl's hand. As they left, Angeliki pressed a chocolate bar into the girl's free hand. At the door, the priest stopped and, turning to Baba Christo, remarked, Don't touch anything.
Fabulous. Nice. Mm. Thank you, Teresa. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, I did too. The village is wonderful. I can, you know, it's the setting. Everything is so natural, the way you've done it, the dialogue, the setting, the people. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I really love the imagery. I really felt as if I was in the Cathenium. And that's paragraph where you're talking about time dragged. Dave was just saying, I could really kind of feel the sleepiness. This, it was kind of soporific, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And such a contrast with the start. I mean, if you think that's the first line of the book, you know, and they say to get straight into a story on the first line of a book. That gets you straight in, doesn't it?
Some bastard's poisoned my dog. Yeah,
and then you're right into the action, you know, and it's not even, you know, you're not trying to make the characters likeable or anything. You're just really drawing them as they are. And then it all sort of slows down after the description of the old lady. And I think the description of the old lady you give there. It just says so much about her that she's so independent and fiercely proud, and she's carrying everything in the one hand she doesn't need for the stick. Yeah, right. Just says everything about her, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's a great show. Yeah.
I like the I particularly like the characterization of the guy whose dog's being poisoned, Nikos. Yeah. It, you know, it's really economically done. You know, he crashed noisily into the Gefenia. And then after talking with the priest, he bangs his chair down at the table, throws himself into it, and shouts, "I want a beer." And you just in like half a dozen words, basically, you have a complete picture.
Yeah. You can even tell that the cafe now is tiny, can't you, because of the door smashing against the table.
Yeah, I think in terms of when you go to do your first edit, I think something I would look for is a few of the adverbs, because you've got noisily, you've got people crashing noisily, you've got people reasoning mildly.
And I did notice as I read it out, actually.
Approach shyly, somebody's sheepishly addressed somebody. You know, so I would look for adverbs when you're editing, see if you can tighten that bit up. Mm.
For the dunce among us, like me, can you what could you do instead? Because I'm not absolutely clear on what this adverb thing is.
The adverb is the Lee word. So we really ought to ask Pat to tell us this. But, so the adverb is actually... So somebody crashes, right, so it's describing how you do it. So crashed noisily. Noisily is the adverb.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. Actually, you could argue the word crashed is good enough because it's quite descriptive in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
You see, sometimes you can find a word which makes the adverb redundant. But there are other times where it just works.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not saying never. I'm just saying I would look... If somebody says something gently, actually, don't tell us they said it gently. Just choose words which imply gentleness.
Right. Yeah.
Or if you want somebody saying something quietly, have somebody go, "Pardon, speak up, I didn't hear you." You know, so you're showing us that they're speaking quietly, not telling us. That's all I'm saying.
And adverbs are supposed to be used... Where did I read this? Like a strong spice in a stew. You need to be very sparing. Oh.
Talking to the woman who throws chili in everything.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I found this article in the New York Times. It's quite an old article by Elmore Leonard. Do you know this one? It says, "Never use an adverb to modify the said," he admonished gravely.
And never use anything but said.
He always says, only ever said.
But, you know, everybody doesn't want to write like Elmore.
No, absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more.
And said on its own can become very repetitive.
I've noticed this.
Yes, but trying to find a different thing is also kind of quite poor writing. Yes. You say admonished, you know, whatever, cried. Belted or whatever.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can leave the speech tag out altogether.
Yeah. You don't have to ascribe to it.
I quite often just write down.
I think it's about variety, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, and also you could use body language. So you could say, you know, he crashed into the fenium and flung himself in a chair and threw his arms over the back of the chair next door. That kind of description you know, bring me a beer and threw his arm over the back of the chair. So you're attributing... Not angrily, but you're attributing the speech without saying who said it, because you're just describing the movement, the action around that piece of speech,
and which tells the reader. Would tell you exactly how he would speak anyway.
Hopefully. Yeah. But that's all I'd say is just keep it
around. Sorry. Sometimes if you're not using any tags like said or yelled or whatever, and the dialogue goes on for a long time, then I sometimes have to look back and say, "Wait a minute, who said that?
Who said what?"
You know? it's a balance, isn't it, between having distinctive voices and not having long, endless pages of dialogue. Yeah,
absolutely. I have to say as well, something I really loved about this piece was the economic use of humour. Because I don't know if this is intended to be a comedy, but there were certain comedic bits, and they were so subtle. So the priest and Nikos, that conversation about who should feed your dog, and you can just hear it, can't you? And the 2:30 bus arriving at 3:30, did you spot that?
Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant. And that's very Greek, isn't it?
Yes.
That's what happens in Greece. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Things don't run on time. Yeah. Allegedly. to use an adverb. Yeah.
But when the bus arrives, it does get a bit exciting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When I've been on holiday in Greece, I sit, you know, there's a little village that where it's a harbour, and everyone sits around the harbour, and the bus arrives, and everybody perks up immediately, as if something exciting is going to happen, and all that's going to happen is people getting on and off the bus.
Oh, but there might be a parcel delivered.
For whom would it be?
Yeah. No, I thought the humour was lovely. So is it a comedy, or is it?
Yeah, it's meant to be light.
Yes.
Although obviously dark elements creep in.
Dog poisoning.
There are things that I do intend it to be. Yeah, I do intend it to be humorous. Yeah.
Lovely.
Well, the rest of it made me
laugh.
So.
And
the
cats
dying, the dogs poisoned.
It's really
humorous.
Well,
it's
life.
Well, it's
a
rich sense of humour.
Yeah. But the other thing is, I know that you have to be, you know, you're trying to be, you said that earlier about respectful, but, you know, mm-hmm. you're trying to draw a picture of village life without actually making Greek people into caricatures, and that's a very fine line to walk.
Yes. Yeah, and obviously you can't have a novel where everybody is nice. There have to be some unpleasant characters, unpleasant events in it, but, you know, hopefully the balance is there and the overall, that my affection for Greece will come through.
I think that comes through in spades.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I loved it. I really did. I can't wait to see what's happening. Does she die? Because she's been out climbing ladders and whitewashing things.
Oh, no.
So that's going to be interesting to see.
We'll look forward to hearing the next episode at some point.
Well, if nothing, this podcast is going to make us write more, isn't it?
Yeah, now I've got to do something.
Yeah.
Next episode.
Yes, we want the next episode.
Remarks. That's brilliant.
Good. Well, I hope they're useful. Okay, Pat, we're going to move to you next, aren't we? Now, you're going to tell us about the Oxford comma.
I am indeed.
You used to teach English, didn't you?
I did.
What age group did you work
11
with?
To 18.
Ah, so secondary school. Is that where you came across the Oxford comma?
No, it isn't, actually. I've never heard of it until earlier this year.
But now I'm an expert.
But now you're an expert.
No, well, I mean, it's not often that punctuation mark gets news coverage, is it? But that's what happened earlier this year in respect of the Oxford comma. It became pivotal in an American court case about drivers for a dairy in Maine.
That's right.
Who became eligible for overtime payments simply because there was a comma missing in the list given of exclusions. I'll explain.
Okay.
As I say, I'd never actually heard of it until then, but I had used it. When I discovered what it was, I realised that, oh, yeah, I've used that loads. Yeah. I always used to call it the optional comma.
Is it sometimes called the Harvard comma as well?
Oh,
now you just kind of see a thing happening. <haven't you?
laughs> She wants to go back to America. She loves the way we write and read.
It is sometimes called the serial comma. But anyway, as I'm sure you all know, one of the main uses of the comma is to separate items in a list. And you may remember, certainly very likely at primary school,
it's an awful long time ago.
But being told by your teachers not to use a comma before the final item in the list.
Oh, I remember that.
Yes, that's right.
It went along with never start a sentence with and or but. I seem to remember.
I remember it well.
Yeah. So, an example. In my bag I have pens, comma, pencils, comma, some tissues, and my purse. So you've got commas then separating the pens and the pencils and the tissues, but you don't need one before my purse, the and.
Before the and.
Yeah.
The and is all you need. However, in some sentences, a comma is needed before that final item, before the and, or sometimes before or, in order to avoid confusion. And that is known as the Oxford comma.
Oh.
So, for example, if you wrote, I love my parents, comma, Lady Gaga and Humpty Dumpty, you would be implying, as I think Teresa has realised, that you're sort of naming your parents Lady Gaga or claiming that your parents are
Lady Gaga and Humpty Dumpty. Yeah.
Whereas in fact, what you were trying to do was loving your parents, loving Lady Gaga and loving Humpty Dumpty, which, yes, it might seem a very strange collection of people, but hey, that's what grammar exercises do. Mm. So what it should be is I love my parents, comma, Lady Gaga, comma, and Humpty Dumpty.
Mm-hmm.
And that then means that the meaning becomes clear, I hope.
Yeah. So yeah. What about a situation where you've got, say I have four bags, pink, comma, blue, comma, green, and black and white, but the black and white is a striped one?
Yes.
Oh God.
Where your aunt is joining...
Because you've got two aunts, which is not allowed anyway, is it? I was always told you never have two aunts in a sentence.
Oh, my gosh.
No, that one was me back.
Where did you
go?
Strange. I went to a grammar school.
In England.
English grammar school.
Absolutely. But, no, where your item, it's one item, but it's black and white.
Mm.
It's like bread and butter.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So you had fish, chips, mushy peas, and bread and butter.
Yeah.
Your bread and butter, you didn't have your butter separately
from
your
bread. Yeah.
And it's the same with your black and white. So, yeah.
Okay.
Can I have gravy as well?
Curry sauce. You can have pickled eggs.
Is it getting near lunchtime?
It is, yes.
Have you solved this problem? Yes.
The last session of the morning.
Yeah.
How did you deal with it in class?
I just used to ride over it.
I'm always trying to deal with it fairly because it confuses me and I don't know whether I should or I shouldn't put that last comma before end. So I just kind of use them alternately. You know,
50-50 chance.
Right. Yeah. That's a good plan.
But maybe now you can sort of apply a little bit more logic to it.
I don't like the expert.
But I think it's used more in America than it is.
So why is it called the Oxford comma if it's used in America?
Right. Why?
No idea.
She's done.
We'll have to refer to the great god Google for that one.
Well, that's fascinating. I think we all share that kind of fascination of the vagaries of the English language. But it's good to have you here, Pat, so that you can solve all these mysteries. Is that really why you like to write? Because you like punctuation and grammar?
No.
I think we talked about this last week. I've always been a keen writer, but I didn't really take myself seriously until a few years ago. And that was when I uncovered a real life story. It just made my brain fizz, really started to spark some ideas. And that's when I started writing the book that I've nearly finished. I was looking at some quotes, you know, people, all these writers have their quotes, and I read one by Maya Angelou. She said, "There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you." Mm. Now, I wouldn't describe it as an agony, but for me it's certainly an itch, carrying a story. Linda, is it an itch or an agony for you?
It's an agony. I have often tried to stop. I have announced to everybody once on my Facebook page, I am not a writer, I do not write, because I wanted somehow to make it clear to myself that I'm stopping. I'm stopping. I'm not even going to try anymore because it was so hard to finish something. But that was because of that guy with the jackhammer in my head. And now I've been able to quash it, and I'm enjoying it a lot more. And apparently, hearing all that, you must know that I can't not write. Mm-hmm. I just have to keep doing it. And I think what you said about, you know, carrying this burden in your soul is true. It has to come out somehow.
Mm. But, so you find it really painful if you can't get the writing out?
If I can't get the writing out, yes. I feel horrible. I feel guilty. And that's when I start yelling at my characters, do something.
Damn you.
And they say back, make us.
dear. What about you, Nicola? What drives you to write?
Well, I wasn't driven to write at all for 56 years. You know, I was thinking about why that was, and I think Mr. Neil, whose name has now come back to me, so if he is still alive, who taught at Durrington High School.
Mr. Neil of Raspberry?
Yes.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah. 1975-76, Durrington High School, Worthing, West Sussex. I think he made me doubt myself, because thinking back, I had written a play. I definitely did want to be a writer when I was younger, because I was reading so much. And I think him telling me that I was no good just somehow subconsciously stifled that. But then when I think about it then, I went on to, I've written 5 business books, so I can obviously write, and people tell me my first book, particularly The Money Gym, changed their lives. Mm-hmm. So obviously I can communicate ideas, and blogging and journaling. So obviously I've been a writer who is hidden from myself. And it was only really meeting you guys that gave me the thought that possibly there was a process I could follow that would bring something out. And then I had a little idea, and I let it sort of germinate for a while. And as I say, reading other people's work and hearing all your work, and I thought, okay, well, perhaps I can come up with something. And I'm using the snowflake method, as you know, which I needed some sort of structure, because I find anything creative that I want to do works better on a sort of slight, simple structural system. And the snowflake method is working really well for me. And I'm galloping on, and the research I'm doing has really fired me up. I sit in cafes and get away from my computer and do research on my phone.
I'm brilliant at research, because anything not to have to write. Yeah. It's great. I won't spend an entire day researching Victorian plumbing. But we're seeing about somebody cleaning the toilet, an outside toilet. But, you know, that's how it goes.
That's a malodorous day.
Yes, it was. Now, Teresa, you told us last week that you only started writing seriously about 10 years ago. Mm. Now, apart from the £5.40 a year that you've made on average in the last 10 years, which is £5.40 more than I have, so I'm not sniffing at it. Yeah. Apart from that, but what drives you as a writer?
I wouldn't say I'm driven. For me, it's fun. I don't have this agony and get it out. For me, it's about living other lives imaginatively. So a bit like acting, it's stepping out of the personality, creating new personalities who then become alive and require something of you, that you write their story and tell their story. I'm not like Linda, who has to write. I'm very lazy, and I'm the least prolific writer here, I expect. But, you know... It's that thing, you know, when you're on a bus or on a train and you see into somebody's window and you think, what life is happening there? Yeah. It's that curiosity the desire to make those stories and create those, you know, what joys, what tragedies, what love and hate is going on in other people's lives and making it up.
I get that. Yeah. And F. Scott Fitzgerald said, you don't write because you want to say something, you write because you have something to say. Do you think that's true, Linda?
Well, sometimes it is, but I'm not sure that that's always the case. I mean, sometimes you have something to say that you really want to... You want to convey a moral kind of lesson or a whatever, although I like more humorous things. But other times it's just, I think I don't have anything that's really important to say, but it's really fun what I'm doing, and I don't want to stop. I'm enjoying the people that are there, and by that I mean just these characters on the page that I start to really like and,
Pat, have you ever had a character that you disliked? I mean, have you kind of deliberately created somebody that you disliked?
No.
No, it's curious, isn't it?
I don't think so.
Because even the baddies, you kind of have to find some redeeming feature in them, don't you? Otherwise, you'd just kill them, wouldn't you?
I was going to say, I have written people I don't like, but it's been in the murder mystery genre where everybody hates them, so everybody is potentially a suspect. So, that's quite fun as well, to write obnoxious, unpleasant people, and also fun to act if you get the chance. Yeah.
I suppose, there are people, I mean, I'm thinking of one story I wrote, or started to write, I've never actually finished it, which was based on some people I had met and I wasn't actually very keen on them.
So that was a kind of revenge?
Yeah.
To describe their halitosis.
But they were interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, might not have been terribly likable. You wouldn't want to spend a great deal of time with them.
Yeah.
But they were interesting to write about.
Mm-hmm. Did you disguise them or did you just give them names?
If it goes to publication ever, then I think I might have to change the names.
There is a particular elegance in a beautifully constructed sentence. And I'm not talking about, you know, adverbs and all that stuff. When you read a beautiful sentence, you just get a thrill of some kind, don't you? And that's why I suppose Daphne's book was quite... she basically went to stay on a Greek island and she wrote a blog while she was writing a novel, and the blog became the book 100 Days of Solitude, and some of the phrasing in that was just so elegant. I just thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to string words together like that and make people feel things. And that's, I think, what's really driven me on now.
Right.
I think we've all got lots in common. Some of us are feeling agony while others are feeling itches, but I think we've all got it in common, you know, that kind of love of words, as you say, and fun. We've all talked about having a bit of fun and enjoying it.
And so, for me as well, it's the challenge.
Yeah.
I think I'm probably the laziest.
I'm Spartacus. Spartacus.
But no, it's something that, you know, I always intended to do, and I never got around to doing it, apart from when needs must. And now it's kind of...
Well, it would be nice to do this,
so bloody get on and do it.
Well, it would be nice to know as well what it is that drives other writers. So we'd love to know why you write. So why not join our Facebook group, Write Club the Podcast, and tell us what drives you. Is it the promise of fame and fortune? Or is there something more visceral? I mean, 540 a year is not to be sniffed at.
No.
So we'd love to know. So please get onto Facebook and look for Write Club the Podcast and tell us what you think. Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Pat and Linda to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Pat, what's on your bedside table?
On my bedside table, it's definitely something very, very topical. It's called To Kill the President. Gets better. By Sam Bourne. It was only published this year, and it tells of a plot to kill the recently elected President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
People have become increasingly unhappy with his bizarre outbursts, his authoritarian style of government, and his extreme measures against women and immigrants. Right. And when a war of words with North Korea escalates, the president comes dangerously close to launching a nuclear attack.
Mm.
So it becomes clear that someone has to act, or the world is likely to be annihilated. The protagonist is a woman who works in the White House, and she discovers that there is actually a plot to kill the president. And so she's faced with the moral dilemma. Should she actually save the president and leave the country at the mercy of an increasingly unstable leader? Or should she commit treason by keeping quiet?
Treason, that's a strong word, isn't it?
Yeah, wow. But that's what it would be.
Yeah.
And with the possibility of, you know, launching the states into a second civil war.
You know?
Now it's scary. Sorry.
I'm sorry. That president's been in office only 1 year, or less than a year, maybe. And who wrote this book?
When you think about the publishing process, he must have been, what's the word, prescient? When you can see the future?
Or it happened very quickly, sold the idea and wrote it very quickly.
I mean, he's a journalist. Mm-hmm. He writes as Jonathan Friedland, as a journalist. Writes in The Guardian and I think some other publications, but he also has written other novels as Sam Bourne.
Mm-hmm.
But it is scarily close.
But the president isn't cool.
No.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I am. They're not quite as much as his previous ones. And I do just wonder whether it was rushed out.
A bit hastily.
A little bit. Yeah.
So Pat, are you trying to get us taken off the air before we get started then with this book?
What? it took me a bit of a time to get into it. I'm nearly halfway through it, and it's only really for the last... I was about a third of the way through, I think, before I really sort of started to want to sort of get back to it.
It sounds like a really great read.
It's got me hooked, and I've got to stick with it.
Yeah,
I kind of know which choice I'd make if I was...
Don't say it. And is he all his books political thrillers?
I'm not sure about political. He's Jewish, and so at least three of his previous ones, he hasn't written that many. I think there are about five or six. About three of them relate to Jewishness or
Judaism.
Yeah,
or being Jewish. The
being Jewish. Yeah. Different. Yeah, one was an interesting one. Dated back to the Second World War, and that was about eugenics.
That was
very interesting. But I think he must have a base or have spent a lot of time in the States, because he does seem to cross over quite frequently. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
good.
I just thought
recommended.
That's a good one.
Recommended.
Thanks, Pat. What about you, Linda? What's on your bedside table?
Oh, I have a nifty little book that a good friend gave to me for my recent birthday. It's called The War of Art.
Oh, I keep hearing about this book, and I haven't read it.
The subtitle is Break Through the Blocks and Win Your Inner Creative Battles. It's by Stephen Pressfield. He's the guy who wrote Bagger Vance, his first novel, Bagger Vance. I don't know if you're familiar or not.
I've heard of it.
Bagger Vance. Oh, you Brit.
BAGGERVANCE.
That's pretty interesting.
Bagger Vance. Bagger Vance. Yeah. Bagger Vance, all one word.
No.
I thought you said Bag of Ants.
Well,
if you could learn to speak English, Lisa.
You listen in British. That's.
It's a southern drawl. Yeah. She needs to enunciate more.
You need to have one ear for your language, one ear for my language. I know you say they're both English, but they're not really. Ours is far.
Sorry, back of hands. Sorry.
Yes. Well, and he also wrote Gates of Fire, a whole lot of books now, but this was his
back. Gates of Fire, three words. Gates
of Fire.
Not Gates of Fire.
But stop it, you two. Stop it. It's my turn. So, anyway, I tell you, I really am in love with this book, and I've just gotten it, but it's fabulous. And it's on my nightstand only, so I can grab it first thing in the morning.
See, they don't even have bedside tables. They have nightstands.
Well, what's your problem with
that? Makes it sound like something so you pee in.
That's a chamber pot.
Yes, well, we have flush toilets in Britain. Oh,
yeah. Oh. Not in the Appalachians. Yeah.
Well, now they have them. Well, some people do. But, there's nothing... At school, we had a two-hole room.
Well, she's lost it. She's off on toilets now. We'll never get her back.
Right, come on, back to the art. The War of Art,
yes. And I think it's just like, it gets me going. So if I read it at night, I'm fired up to write. I can't sleep, so I have to wait and do some of it in the morning. It's really easy to read. It comes in really succinct kinds of bursts. Some of the pages are some of the entries are less than a page. Others might be one or two pages. It's not like those how to write books that go on and on with all that gray matter on the page. You know,
this is a book that's highly recommended in business circles to business leaders.
Book.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think it's to a writer what boot camp is to a soldier, something that gets you really prepared. But he puts a face on your very fiercest enemy, resistance. And he tells you exactly how to defeat it. Let me read you a couple of entries here. Mm-hmm. They're not long, okay? This one, this page is Resistance Plays for Keep. Resistance's goal is not to wound or disable. Resistance aims to kill. Its target is the epicenter of our being, our genius, our soul, the unique and priceless gift we were put on earth to give, and that no one else has but us. Resistance means business. When we fight it, we are in a war to the death. Yeah. And then he talks about going pro, and I love this.
Oh, yeah.
We've talked about this before in Right Club. There's no mystery to turning pro. It's a decision brought about by an act of will. We make up our mind to view ourselves as pros, and we do it. Simple as that. Isn't that wonderful?
It's about, it's about stepping up, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Let me give you one more. I have it marked here. Oh, find it. All right. Yeah, this is again about going pro. I love this one. The amateur underestimating resistances. Cunning permits the flu to keep him from his chapters. He believes the serpent's voice in his head that says, mailing off that manuscript is more important than doing the day's work. The professional has learned better. He respects resistance. He knows if he caves in today, no matter how plausible the pretext, he'll be twice as likely to cave in tomorrow. The professional knows that resistance is like a telemarketer. If you so much as say hello, you're finished. The pro doesn't even pick up the phone. Stays at work. Isn't that wonderful?
That's fabulous. That's going on my Christmases, my letter to Santa. And we will be putting links onto our Facebook group for all of the books that we've talked about.
Right.
Can I just say, if you're going to order that, anyone, The War of Art, there's another book called Create, Don't Hate.
Yeah.
By Dan Norris. The two should be read together. They are really good.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Simon Preston
put the link up to that too.
A lot of other of these little handy-dandy books. I think they're about five.
Handy-dandy. Handy-dandy.
Yeah, well. You don't say handy dandy. What's your word?
We will be now.
That's handy dandy.
Just handy. Just handy. Well, ours is so much more colourful.
Thanks, Linda. That was great. It's nearly the end of Right Club, the podcast for this week. We do hope you've enjoyed the show. As I said, we will be putting links and resources onto our Facebook group. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And then every new show will be automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please, if you've enjoyed this podcast, take a few minutes to give us a 5-star review. Tell everybody how good it is. So, until next week, it's goodbye.
Bye.
See ya.
Y'all come back now.